Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov. And with me today is past, present, and future guest, Joe Reed, host of this Had Oscar Buzz podcast, managing editor, primetimer.com. He is here today to talk with me about the state dinner. But before
state
we get to
dinner.
That, Joe, the state
yes.
dinner, but before we get to that, let's rewind a little
yes.
bit.
Right.
Did you watch this show in 99? Were you?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Okay. So you were in it from the jump.
Yeah, I was in college in 99, which I think I mentioned mm-hmm. when I was on your show previously.
Mm-hmm.
99 would have been my sophomore year in college. And this was like the big show of that fall, obviously.
Really?
I remember it being like the prestige, not maybe probably not like among college sophomores, but I was special. I was, you know, I was really smart for a college kid.
Sure.
No, but like this was like the big NBC prestige pilot. I remember it got a ton of advertising, and I was already very aware of Aaron Sorkin. Sports Night had been on the year before, and I really liked that. I was a big fan of The American President, and obviously The West Wing felt like there are a couple things in this episode I feel like really reminded me of The American President. But also, like more so than that, I was such a 12-year-old, 13-year-old nerd for A Few Good Men. Like, again.
Well, sure, sure.
An incredibly cool kid. A Few Good Men wasn't like the, was not the first R-rated movie I ever saw. In fact, I think we talked about how, when we talked about Dead Calm, that might have been my first R-rated movie. But like, was definitely an early one for me that I like watched on VHS after like right after it was available on VHS and got so obsessed with it. I was very, very much a kid who liked to feel like an adult when I was a kid. You know what I mean? Sure, I like to feel grown up. And like A Few Good Men was like a grown-ups movie. I knew it was an Oscar nominee. I knew it was like, you know, these big movie stars and whatever. And I got so obsessed with it. And I rented it a bunch of times from the video store. And then, and I might have mentioned this on my podcast or maybe not, whatever. New to you. Remember when like the pay-per-view movie channels used to operate on the same principle as like the pay-per-view porn channels where like it would scramble, like you would be able to go to a channel for it and it would scramble, but the audio was like whatever. And I had already seen A Few Good Men probably like four or five times by then. So that's I remember the one summer it was on pay-per-view movie channel and I would just go to the scrambled channel and just listen to it like it was a radio play.
This would make Aaron Sorkin so happy to hear.
It really would. It's very much that like, what was that play he did about the invention of television that didn't do
anything? Oh, the Farnsworth invention?
The Farnsworth invention. This is very the Farnsworth invention. I feel like. This is what television was made for. It was for precocious little 13-year-old pseudo-intellectuals to listen to.
I'm kind
to
of surprised he hasn't adapted that into a film, quite frankly. Or like a miniseries or something. Like that seems so, like, why hasn't that happened yet?
Especially because he doesn't seem to be somebody who takes failure well, you know what I mean? Like he would want to sort of rehab that maybe if at all possible.
Yes, he would absolutely want a reclamation on this brilliant thing that he did.
But I got to the point where I could like quote almost the entire film of A Few Good Men. And if I catch it on cable now and I'll watch it, I'll still be able to just like, I could probably just like lip sync to the entire thing.
Well, there's something like, very melodious about the way
this
he
is
writes.
My thing with Aaron Sorkin's writing.
Right?
This is always my thing with Aaron Sorkin's writing is even when it's not, even when it's frustrating or it can be sexist, it can be blinkered, it can be politically weird or whatever.
Yes.
But like the way the, and he talks about this on The West Wing, because obviously The West Wing is about speechwriters. And he has Toby go on about these, you know, that like speechwriting can have a rhythm and a timbre and it's like music and whatever. And it's just like, that's annoying. But yes, that is true. Like, yes, Aaron, like you are.
There's even a moment in this episode where they're in Toby's office and Rob Lowe reads him a line that he wrote.
Yes.
And it's jarring for a bunch of reasons. First of all, it's badly written, but it's also it stands out in a show that is so obviously specific about the way that people speak. And then to hear this line come out of Rob Lowe's mouth that is so jarring and stilted and awful.
Yeah.
And also dumb, like doesn't have anything to say. Like it's funny.
But that's why his shows I think are so incredibly rewatchable, even when they're not like I will rewatch The Newsroom. And like The Newsroom I had very, very mixed feelings on. I do feel like it got good for a while there. But like even when, you know, The Newsroom is bad, like it's rewatchable in the way that musicals are rewatchable and like that you like listen to songs over and over again because it's just like it hits your ear, or at least my ear, very well. And The West Wing I have rewatched through countless times. I remember it used to be on like weekday morning reruns on Bravo and I would watch that all the time. It was always my like chill out show on Netflix, and now that it's not on Netflix anymore, I've got to like retrain my system to go to HBO Max for it, HBO Max always freezes on me for some reason. So whatever.
A lot of complaints about the HBO Max app. I don't have, I mean, I not to get all whatever, but they did have a very strange glitch for about a week and a half last week where they fucked with the way that it works with an Apple TV and it was a nightmare. And they fixed it, thankfully. But I do want to, I want to kind of hone in on what you're talking about in terms of Aaron's writing, because I do think that, and this might sound sacrilege, but I think that other directors understand Aaron's writing better than Aaron does. Yeah. Like I'm not sure that he's completely, and I imagine he'll get there, but in the two films that he's done thus far, he doesn't seem to understand that every word he writes doesn't need the same amount of emphasis.
Right.
Like, you can't have the whole thing dialed at 11 or you become numb to it. Like that was my big issue with one of my big issues with Chicago 7, which was that every word was so important to Aaron Sorkin that unfortunately you became sort of like deadened to it. Does that make sense?
I haven't gotten to the rewatchable place with Chicago 7 yet, even though I really did enjoy it quite a bit when I first watched it. I have gotten to that place with Molly's Game where I will acknowledge the flaws in Molly's Game, but like Molly's Game is on HBO roughly seven times a day somehow. And every time I come across it, I'll stick with it for at least a little bit. It's just incredibly, even with like poor Idris Elba in that movie, the dialogue that man has to like get his like accent around is like already kind of shaky. Like, well, he's done good American accents before in the past, but like him doing that particular task, it was tough. It was tough for Idris. But
He had a mouthful of marbles on that one for sure.
Really, really did. But I think
Molly's Game opens like gangbusters, and I could watch the opening of Molly's Game many times over. It gets bumpy, but it starts with just and it actually segues quite well to this episode to a certain degree, which is that this episode, watching it yesterday, was maybe the first episode of the show thus far, and this is episode 7, where it felt classically West Wing to me, like where it all was really clicking.
It's so funny that you say that because I, in a previous sort of incarnation, whatever, I had my, because now the Tumblr that I use the most is just the one that we post our episodes descriptions for This at Oscar Buzz. And This at Oscar Buzz started as a Tumblr, but I had a Tumblr just for like myself and like whatever like weird shit I wanted to write. And it became for a while a West Wing Tumblr where I was just like rewatching the whole series. And I got through like season 2 and then I just petered off as I often would do. But I went back and I read my entry that I wrote about the state dinner. And I said that exact same thing. I was like, this is the first episode that really feels like it comes together and is classic West Wing. It still has a little, the thing I noticed this time was after the opening credits, it still has that little sort of like toodly music at the beginning where it's just like, I'm not sure I need you to be pushing the whimsy on this.
I agree.
But yeah, the first handful of episodes, there's definitely like most of it's there, but there's, you're right. This is the first one that feels like all of the storylines are sort of moving in time with each other and everything feels like it's running on rails in the way that it will for the next, you know, several seasons until probably Sorkin leaves.
It's interesting too, because like up until this point, it's a calibration thing in the sense of like, how do I feed all these mouths, right? Like, how do I get all these characters to feel balanced? Right. And this is the first episode where they achieve that balance, where everyone feels like they have the right amount of screen time. And once you remove Mandy from the equation, which obviously happens, then her stuff can get spread amongst her, you know what I mean? Her real estate gets spread amongst everybody else. And then the balance really starts to.
And it's impressive that they get that balance right in this episode, because this episode introduces a new character. This is the first Abby Bartlett episode, which is the reason why I asked for this one when you gave me the selection of episodes.
Oh, I'm super excited to talk about Stalker Channing and the Abby character. Yeah. I want to give a brief synopsis here real quick for our listeners. As a night's stylish state dinner, honoring the Indonesian president looms in the background, President Bartlett keeps his eye on a spat of potentially explosive problems, an FBI hostage situation with dozens of militant survivalists, a class 4 hurricane bearing down on a carrier group at sea, and an impending national trucker strike. Behind the scenes, the gracious First Lady prepares to host the dinner. A pushy reporter flirts with CJ, Josh, and Toby, corner an Indonesian government official to ask for a favor, and a surprise Sam spies his call girlfriend Lori at an event. Oh, we will talk about Lori in a second. State Dinner aired on November 10th, 1999. It was written by Aaron Sorkin and Paul Redford, directed by Tommy Shalhoub. 13.66 million viewers tuned into this episode. I mean, listen, I've been pretty open about my feelings about the Laurie storyline in previous episodes. I stand by the fact that I think it's arguably one of the worst storylines this show's ever done.
It is. And it's too bad because I love that actress so much. Lisa Edelstein, yes. Thank you.
She's tremendous. It's just, it's ham-fisted. It feels so networky in a dumb late 90s way.
Yes.
And it makes
it feels
Sam
like it's
so
there because, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, please.
It feels like it's there because at the beginning of the series, there was this sense that it was, that Rob Lowe was the lead among, like he was elevated among the rest of the staffers. And you needed to give Rob Lowe an A story that mm-hmm. like would go across episodes. And mm-hmm. it's so funny how quickly this show realizes and sort of clicks into its own rhythm about the fact that it is such an ensemble show, and that, yep. you know, yep. that obviously famously Bartlett was supposed to be just a, you know, rarely seen character, and that mm-hmm. corrected itself because Martin Sheen's performance was so compelling. And Rob Lowe sort of had the opposite happen to him, where like he was supposed yeah. to be the main guy, and that he kind of got brought down to sea level with the other cast members. And I think this feels like almost like a vestigial tale of this, because
I agree.
We're supposed to give like him something extra special to do, but it plays into Sorkin's worst tendencies when he's writing about couples and romance. Yeah, exactly. Like he stumbles his way into good ones every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I am a staunch Josh and Amy person. I think that is incredibly written romance that had like a lot of logistical hurdles for the fact that they couldn't keep Mary Louise Parker as much as they would have probably wanted to.
Yeah.
But I'm getting well ahead of myself.
No. I agree. It's that I think the reason that jumps out so much to you and quite frankly to me as well, is because how evenly keeled it is, how balanced it is. The and I hate to use power dynamics, but the power dynamics between the two of them is balanced. You can feel that she is a worthy opponent, quote unquote, to Josh,
exactly.
and vice versa.
He's the kind of character who needs something like that, because he's always one.
Right.
That's why his relationship with Donna never fully works for me, because I think for so long, he's so condescending to her that it like...
Sure.
It, and I know that that's like whatever screwball dynamic, yada, 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 but it's just like it totally poisons that well for me. And I'm the person who, remember that one episode, again, I'm getting super ahead of myself. I don't know how much you like to talk about future episodes. That one episode where CJ finally has like, she and Donna are sort of in lockdown in the office together. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, why haven't you gotten a better job than this? It's been 5 years. And it's just like, that's me. That's CJ is me in that scene. And
I absolutely get that. I mean, I'm a fan of Josh and Donna as well. I don't necessarily think you have to choose one or the other. I think that the Josh and Donna relationship is very endearing and very sweet. I think that despite the fact that he's her boss, she pretty much has him wrapped around her finger. So it is not necessarily as egregious as perhaps some people might feel. And Janelle Maloney is just, I mean, from the jump, I've said this quote a couple times in the episodes, but I'll repeat it, John Spencer had his first scene with her in the pilot, and he goes up to her and he's like, can you get Josh for me? And she screams Josh over her shoulder, and he says, I could have done that. And then when they were finished, he turned to her and said, you're going to be here till the curtain comes down.
What a great story.
It's a great story, and it's just like an acknowledgement of the fact that from the jump, Mandy never had a chance. That Donna was clearly the right partner for the banter and for the what have you with Josh. She also, quite frankly, and this was something that Mandy could never do, was that Donna served a purpose for the audience, which is that Josh is always explaining stuff to her about policy that we need.
Yes, explained Donna was indispensable.
I want to read just a couple quick clips of some interviews with Stalker Channing Abby character. She said, they sent me the script and I was barely in it. Stalker Channing recalls about her initial appearance in the show. She says that she was very disappointed with the size of the part and frustrated because she had no idea what the character should be. I'm very used to spending either time figuring out who the character looks like, sounds like, how old she is, what her background is, or I'm presented with the information so I sort of know what's happening from the writer or director, she said. She didn't have the time to do that on her own, and the West Wing co-creator Aaron Sorkin didn't supply the biographical information. No, I don't work that way, was all he initially said. She was working on another project in Toronto at the time when the West Wing airlifted her to shoot her short scene. I literally got off the plane, went into wardrobe, went to set, and there was Martin Sheen who I had never met in my entire life, in a white tie and tails. I was in an evening dress, and I said, "Hi, we've never met, but I think we've been married for about 50 million years." He laughed and later said, "I think we have daughters." "We have daughters?" she exclaimed. "Action," the director yelled. The conversation ended. God. The scene began, and Channing and Martin, Sheen's President Bartlett, had great chemistry. It's just luck. I think that there's something about... there's one other thing I'll read here. After we finished the first take, I, Stalker Channing, said to the West Wing then writer Aaron Sorkin, "You've got to tell me who Abby is," she said. "I can't tell you that," he said. "Then why am I here?" He said, "Talent." I said, "We have no time for flattery." I think that there's something...
Oh, that's so fascinating.
...really funny about the way Aaron Sorkin perceives actors... You know, that they are vehicles for his words.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that he'll figure it out when there's a gun to his head, when it comes to where these characters come from, how it all kind of works itself out. Yeah. And I respect the hell out of it because that seems impossible and I don't know how he does it. But I also think that as an actor, and quite frankly, as a viewer, there's times where I do find myself feeling like we haven't plotted this out.
Well, and this would become a problem for him logistically as the series went on, when, and a lot of that was he wasn't getting scripts in early enough, but they couldn't keep a guest star. They couldn't hold on to Ainsley Hayes for any longer. They couldn't hold on to Mary Louise Parker longer than they did that. And like, you have these guest sort of arcs that feel like if you watch season two, there are parts where it feels like Ainsley Hayes is about to become like a lead character on that show. Where like, not even just her introduction episode, but like there are episodes where like it's framed through her eyes. And it's just like, oh, okay, she's going to be like a major like part of the show. And then just because I think logistics of it, and I haven't really heard anything from Emily Proctor about that otherwise, but like it just feels like they weren't able to write ahead enough to know how much they were going to need her. And then she got whatever CSI Miami and it was all over.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's exactly how you've laid it out. I think that, you know, a lead role on a procedural television CBS spinoff came her way. Yeah. And my guess is that her agent said, "Shit or get off the pot," to the West Wing. And they didn't know, to your point, how far ahead they were going to go with her. I love Ainsley Hayes. I think she's one of the best characters. I mean, season two is still my favorite season of the show.
By far.
I think because it feels so, whether it is or it isn't, rounded off. Like, it really feels like it comes back on itself. When you think about the first episode to the last episode of that season, it feels complete in a way that no other season of the show really does. Yeah. So, obviously, September 11th changed everything in terms of the way that the show was, its ideologies and the way that it could do what it wanted to do for obvious reasons.
Yes.
But I think to your point, you know, Sorkin writes things literally would write scenes before they shoot. Like, they wouldn't even have full scripts. I mean, there were no real, when they did have table reads, you know, they might not even be for complete scripts. So it's definitely a troubled production in terms of how hard that must have been to do.
Well, I was going to say, it makes me give even more credit to Stalker Channing, and I am already prepared to give all the credit to Stalker Channing.
As you
should. One of my favorite performances on the show, whenever she's on. And she, I think you can sense, if you compare the state dinner to like maybe the next handful of performances, by the time she shows up for the State of the Union episode where he collapses, there's already more sort of playful combativeness between the two of them when she says, like, you know, she's said something about just like, "I could like beat you to death" or something like that. Yeah. And like, you do see that a little bit in here, but like there's the big scene between them is the one where she talks about how he's got an ego the size of Montana, yada, yada. But she do loves to see him, you know, try and solve it. And it's like, it's very sort of like admiring. You could tell like there's some, you know, grit in there with her. Obviously you see that a lot in her scene with CJ, where she's just sort of, you know, she's in the game with the staffers in a way, and yet also like very like into CJ's personal life and whatnot.
I think it's also interesting that Stalker Channing said that the prickliness of Abby's character was because she was annoyed, but she didn't know anything about her.
I freaking love that. I think that's so fantastic. Yeah.
It's just like, I mean, that
and it becomes such a big part of her character. Like, so many of the best scenes between her and Jed are when they're sparring about this or that.
Yes.
And it's so funny because I've always thought that The West Wing was such a reaction to the Clinton presidency, was essentially, what if the idealism of Clinton without the skeeziness of Bill Clinton?
Correct.
What without the scandal of Bill Clinton? What if he had like a really morally upstanding guy? But yet it would borrow things like Rob Lowe is obviously very George Stephanopoulos and you know, sort of stuff like that. And a lot of Jed and Abby's relationship felt very Bill and Hillary, like a marriage of equals. Like they both had their agendas and they both had their ambitions. And she was obviously a lot of what Abby is in terms of like, she's a doctor and she wants to, you know, have her own identity. That's all very Hillary Rodham Clinton. And so it's funny that, you know, that relationship between them becomes this sort of like, it's, you know, what if, again, what if Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, were sparring, but like we believed that they really loved each other. You know what I mean? That
kind no, of for thing. Sure. And I think there's also something, you know, the Clintons have always been perceived as deeply political animals.
Yes.
As these sort of Machiavellian what have yous, puppet
exactly.
masters. You
right.
don't sense that from the Bartlets at all.
Right.
You don't really get the impression that these two are twirling mustaches. They right. they both have you know, aspirations, and they both hope to make the country a better place.
Yes.
But they're not doing it through back channel weird fucked up things that
right.
people perceive the Clintons to have done.
Right.
So
yeah. And you'll get that in a few episodes in White House Pro-Am when he literally is just like, I will not be these people. We will not be these people who go through the press right. like to maneuver around each other. And I think that's very, very much a statement about what Sorkin wanted that marriage to be as opposed to what the perception of the Clintons was.
I think there's also something, you know, to unpack their marriage even farther. You know, season three is when we really see the fallout of the censure of him lying to the public and of her, you know, medicating him. Which is obviously not allowed. And her having to lose her license, him being censured, what that does to their marriage. There's this a great episode in season three, Dead Irish Writers, where you really get to, where you really get to see Abby with the other women in, you know, you've got Donna, you have, oh my God.
CJ and Amy.
CJ and Amy Gardner, of course.
Yeah.
And Abby sort of sitting on this high horse of indignation about what happened. And then Don obviously taking her down a notch and being like, you know, you knew he was the president. You knew you were a doctor when you were giving him the drugs.
Right.
It's, you know, it's that type of stuff where, and again, throwing out, you know, how character arcs are laid out and how Sorkin looks at them from 30,000 feet or if he even does. But it's a beautiful sort of ability to be able to take Abby, look inside, take her down a notch, really be able to sort of show the humility of this person who doesn't even seem like a human being. I mean, there's a great moment in this episode. In fact, it's one of my favorite moments is when Lori gets to meet Abby.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's a real sort of starstruck awe yes. moment for Lori. And you really get to think like, yeah, I can't even imagine what it's like to be around these people. They might seem like superheroes.
It introduces one of my favorite sort of character beats with Abby that we'll see recur a lot through the series, which is how familiar she is with the staff and how much she sort of acts with them on a level where she mentions that he's taking the Teamsters out by the woodshed, essentially. And he's like, why? And she's like, because he can't stop a hurricane and he can't save a shooting victim.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and she's, you know, you see that again with her, with Leo, when she's, you know, sort of she's in on the strategy talk, but she's not from that level on high that Jed comes to them with, where if you feel like they can sort of act a little bit more on a level with Abby. And I love that. I love every time we see little signs of that in her appearances.
And I also love when she pulls rank on them too.
Also that. CJ can't have any cider. I thought of that when I thought of that because the scene with her and CJ, it still feels like every once in a while, early Alice and Janney on this show feels like a little bit of a different Alice and Janney, a little more almost sitcom-y. Not to say that she wasn't great, because she was, but I feel like even the way she's wardrobe has her sort of like dressed and made up, where I literally wrote down, she's styled very much in the way that Anna Deavere Smith's character in American President is styled. She was the press secretary in that one. And I feel like they still are sort of working on getting to sort of what the sort of like, CJ becomes a lot sleeker as the sort of show goes along.
Yeah, I actually was going to bring that up too. This CJ's character doesn't really come into focus, if you ask me, until the tail end of this season even. I really get the impression that Aaron Sorkin doesn't know what he has yet with her. Yes. Like he doesn't know her tool belt, and he doesn't know what he can do with her. And then CJ really, I mean, obviously she's one of the best characters ever on television, really blossoms and becomes her own. Because right now she still feels very small. She still feels like a supporting player, you know?
You know what I think does it? I think for me is the storyline where she gets closed out of the loop on the India-Pakistan thing. And she really has to like assert herself and be like, don't do that. Like, you can trust me. You can pull me in and I can be part of, you know, the strategy here. And I think that's a big one for her. But this deal feels a little bit like, she has a character in Primary Colors where she's a teacher.
Falls on the stairs.
And she sort of falls on the stairs. And this feels a little bit like you get that in the pilot of The West Wing where she sort of like she falls on the treadmill and whatever. And like Sorkin does enjoy having his female characters fall down.
He does, unfortunately.
But like, I feel like that's a little like CJ 1.0. I think we're still a little bit in CJ 1.0 here.
I mean, this is going to sound superficial, but her hair too. Like it's just a lot of it feels frumpy and oddly kind of insecure almost in a weird way. And I think that to your point, I think they find her spine and I think that Allison Janney finds her spine. And when that starts to happen is when the character really turns into something three dimensional and really tremendous. But this episode opens with CJ with a great classic West Wing opening where you have CJ talking to the press, more specifically in style, about Abby's outfit for the state dinner. And then you get your three converging storylines all coming at CJ. So in this cold open, the whole episode is laid out for you, which is Josh preps her on Hurricane Sarah, which is about to make landfall in Georgia. Sam tells her about the truck drivers, Teamsters, and they're voting to strike. And Toby preps CJ on a potential hostage situation that's brewing in McLean, Idaho. And then in a classic West Wing way, the whole opening comes back on itself with an InStyle reporter asking Abby, asking again about Abby's outfit. And just to prove that like, and classic CJ form, she's like, and ironically, the thing I'm going to be asked about most is, and then the tee up of the joke. I mean, it's the first opening that I really kind of like got the goosebumps of like, okay, this is now we're humming. He's figured out the structure of how this show can work.
Some of the earlier cold opens, the opening credits sort of just happen and you're just like, oh, I guess like that scene is done. And this one feels very, you're right, it feels very West Wing. It's just like, we're wrapping it all up at the end and putting a button on that cold open. And then it's like flourish and it's opening credits music.
It feels also just very, up until this point, and to underline your point, the cold opens don't really feel like cold opens. Right. And I think he's now cracked, oh, I can do a mini play in 7 minutes or 4 minutes or however long it is and have a nice little dot at the end of it. And also use it as a microcosm of the episode to come, as opposed to. So it really is. It's really special. Josh tells Donna they needed an Indonesian interpreter. Leo briefs the staff about the trucker strike that's going on, that it's about job tiers and wages and benefits and what have you. Leo sits with the truckers union and the corporations to try to work something out. So Mandy is given a full-throated storyline for the first time on the West Wing.
Well, and one that feels at least part of the show. Like, she got a bunch of storyline in the first two episodes, but it was so outside of everything else that was going on. And I think that really helped to kill that character right off the bat, because like it really, she's so incredibly obnoxious in those first two episodes where she's, you know, driving up on the curb and she's haranguing the senator or whatever and all this sort of stuff. And it's just like, why? Like, again, I feel like at the beginning, she was also sort of being set up to be a lead on the show. And I think very quickly, the show realized that like that's not working. And so they really pulled back on that one quickly. Because at the like Rob Lowe and Moira Kelly were the only two besides Martin Sheen were the two like names.
No
like
names.
She had been in The Cutting Edge. She had been in With Honors and all these movies. And Rob Lowe was Rob Lowe. But like even John Spencer, I only really knew John Spencer because he had been on L.A. Law. I knew he was like this great character actor. But like Richard Schiff, I didn't know from anybody. Bradley Whitford. I was a Happy Gilmore person more than a Billy Madison person. So I didn't even really know Bradley Whitford by that point.
I kind of knew him from Adventures in Babysitting.
I take that back. You're absolutely right. He's the boyfriend in Adventures in Babysitting. How dare I? I loved that movie. But like Moira Kelly was like, again, Martin Sheen aside, the second most highest profile member of that cast. And I find Mandy in the first season so fascinating to sort of track her because like it's, you know, why did everything else on the show succeeded and why did this fail so badly? And I think some people chalk it up to Moira Kelly, and I don't, because I think Moira Kelly can be a very, very good actress. And
yeah, I don't think it's her fault either.
I think that character is written really abrasively from the beginning, and not in a way that, like, we don't accept abrasiveness from female characters. Like, sometimes show, like, this is not a Skyler White situation from Breaking Bad, where, like, I have a very, very big hair trigger for that. I think she's, like, legitimately written incredibly abrasively. And by the time they start to sort of soften that, I think it's already too late. This episode almost works for her because I think if they would have just held back from continually pointing out that she was finally getting in the game, I would have liked it a lot better for her. If they would have kept from this like runner of her being like, Josh, are you mad? Because I'm getting in the game. And it's just like, for fuck's sake, I don't care about you and Josh. I don't care about Mandy and Josh as an ex-couple. I just truly don't. And
they don't even really hit it very hard is the weird thing. Like they do,
but they keep mentioning it. Like it's just weird. It's But like she's the one she's on the right track about the Teamsters union thing. And like she's the only one really expressing like liberal ideals in this liberal White House about like employment and like all this stuff about like it's actually like a really prescient issue in terms of like full-time employees versus part-time contractors, where like that thing has only grown more and more disparate, you know, as the years go on. But then at the same episode, they have her take the malicious side the Ruby Ridge thing. And it's just like, I don't understand. Crazy. There's no consistency in this character.
Well, I think that Alan Sepinwall said it in the pilot episode, but that, you know, that one of the big issues with Mandy's character is that fundamentally she's antagonistic to this administration, right? Like she is always the one, or generally speaking, tends to be the one who takes the most pragmatic way of looking at things when, however, you're living inside an administration that is perhaps naive, but has like grand sweeping notions of things that it can do. And Mandy has to be the one to go, tisk, tisk, that can't happen. And and I'm sure that to write that character is fucking annoying. Yeah. And to sort of to keep having to take the wind out of your sails sucks. And then on top of all of that, even within this episode, she's more concerned about the PR ramifications of this hostage situation than she is that lives might be in danger. It's just a big mess.
Well, and part of that is her role in the administration because she is the media director. And so like that is technically her job. But the problem to that also is the only characters we really are around are essentially the communication staff. Josh is deputy chief of staff, but like Toby, Sam, CJ, they're all communications. They already have an eye on how this is going to, like, how we need to make this to the public. So Mandy feels like an extra appendage that we don't really need, and is constantly being written, like you said, sort of confrontationally with them, and then even the way this episode sort of like brings it around where she advocates for the mediator to get sent in to the separatists in Idaho and the mediator gets shot and Josh sort of tells her that in the middle of this state dinner. And then, but it's this weird like comedic beat where she's like, I'm going to be sick and whatever. And it's just like, and that's the end of that storyline. We don't really hear any more from Mandy in this episode.
I don't know that I felt it as comedic. I actually, did you feel it as comedic?
I think it's, well, I don't, but I think that particular beat was played right. that way. The way right, she right, says, right. like, I right, think I'm going right. to be sick. And then she leaves and Josh is just sort of like there yeah, by himself. Yeah. I think it's very incongruous with the rest of the thing. And the fact that we don't see Mandy again, that's the last we sort of hear from her on that issue.
Yeah.
Like, sort of cuts that off at the knees.
And then she's the only time we see her is at the end when she's being hugged by Josh during the final scene, which we'll talk about later. But I want to read a line of hers, which really hits home in 2021. It's not the nuts that are the greatest threat to democracy. Oh, it's the unbridled power of the state over its citizens. Woohoo!
Little differently in 2021.
just a smidge. Yeah.
But that seemed like the enlightened opinion, right? The
Correct.
Enlightened opinion, which is, you know, I will defend to the death, you know, your right to, you know, act in accordance with freedom
Liberty.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now it's just like, no, maybe the danger is all these people with guns who feel like they shouldn't have to
right.
exist.
QAnon is like a fucking real threat to democracy.
Right. Yeah.
And like, you
got Mandy QAnon now? Is 2020?
Probably. Mandy? Maybe she is. That's where
She's
Mandy
Q.
went.
Oh, shit. She's that's Q. where she went.
Mandy is Q. Is phenomenal. Yeah, I mean, by the way, it's not that far from where she's at. But Leo tells Bartlett that he's moving a battle carrier group because of the hurricane as a safety precaution. Hint, hint, that might not work out. Toby wants the president's toast to be candid about Indonesia. Danny talks to CJ about the Vermeer protesters outside the press conference. I mean, it's the Vermeer thing I liked. I know that it's
I did
kind
too.
Of,
in many ways, it feels like one more thing. It feels like, it, you know, it's just like we've got so much going on. And yeah. and it's almost handled that way too, where CJ is like, now I got to learn what the fuck this thing is. and Abby is able to sort of like put it to bed in like literally the span of one sentence, which I kind of love. But it does feel it's the runner of all runners where it's just like, oh, right, that thing. We have to figure out what that thing is.
What are your feelings on CJ and Danny?
At this point, watching the show, especially the first time, I was really, really into CJ and Danny. And I think I think their chemistry, those two actors, takes that a long way. I think way that Danny is written is often a problem for me. There's a lot of that sort of like, sort of playful sexism that Sorkin sometimes thinks is cute and a throwback in a way that I'm always just like, did we have to, you know, write Danny specifically that way? But I think.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
CJ and Danny ultimately... I just think the chemistry between them is really good, and I think those are really good CJ scenes. But it's it can be a little much sometimes.
There's a little bit of no means no, Danny. But then there's also CJ, you're giving mixed signals. So I
right.
there's definitely kind of it doesn't know where to live in that. It made me think right. of watching this a little bit and thinking about Danny until CJ relents is the wrong word, but finds a way to navigate that relationship. But it made me think of Studio 60, Bradley Whitford, Amanda Peet, She's pregnant, eating a sandwich, and he's like, buckle up, baby, I'm coming for you. There's nothing you can do. And I'm just like, what the fuck is happening?
It's so terrible. So I recapped that series for Television Without Pity. So I recapped that till the bitter end. That was one where even when they were burning off episodes in the summertime to end it, I recapped all those episodes. Yeah. And I like Amanda Peet so much. And I thought her performance in the pilot was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'm into this. And the fact that that's where that storyline went for her, and the fact that she and Bradley Whitford's character, not only like the determination to couple them up felt so aggressive, especially when like Matthew Perry and Sarah Paulson's characters mm-hmm. were like, they had such a hard time making that work, and they struggled really, really hard to make that work. And I'm just like, you already have your handfuls with this thing. Like, don't make double the trouble for yourself trying to now make this relationship happen. And you're right. It was that episode where they were both like locked on the roof or whatever. And he was basically just like, no matter what you may say that you do not want a relationship, but you do want a relationship, and I'm going to wear you down. And it's just like,
oh my God. Oh, it's crazy. I mean, listen, that show, obviously, I mean, we could do an entire podcast on Studio 60, which
I'll be here for.
Gladly do. Yeah. I'll just say this. I do think that it did feel like the odds were stacked against that show in ways that maybe Aaron Sorkin wasn't even cognizant. I feel like the pressure that show had on it to perform, to save NBC, that it was going to be the show. And you're just like, what are you doing to a show that, quite frankly, if it was just kind of left alone to its own devices, we never would have got, you know, kidnappings and various things like that.
Right.
But there's all these weird stakes that are jammed into it. Amanda Peet gets pregnant, which is not her fault. Obviously, she gets pregnant, and they either choose to write it in the show or write her off the show.
Right.
So that bakes them into this, well, what are we going to do? Which fast forwards a relationship that perhaps wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Right.
This is all to say that the Danny and CJ stuff on the West Wing feels very organic. Like, it doesn't feel, you know, jammed in there or shoehorned in there. I'm with you that I wish that Danny up top was a little less me, and not listening to the nose that CJ professionally was trying to have those borders.
Yeah.
But you also get a great line where he's like, I think you handled the Vermeer scandal really well. I mean, so it's just, I do appreciate it. And to your point, it's all in the casting. Had this not been Timothy Busfield and Allison Janney, who knows what it might have looked like.
And I also feel like the power dynamics of their jobs are actually really interesting, where sometimes he has the upper hand on her because he can sort of wield the power of the press. And sometimes she has the upper hand on him because she can, you know, control the flow of information. And they are in the same pit, essentially, but working different sides of the ball. And what the complications that does for that relationship, I think that's all really interesting.
It's great.
And this is the first episode where you get, I don't think they had really had anything sort of romantic up until this point.
Correct. This was the first time that flirting and all that stuff even came up. And she, to I guess someone's credit, I mean, I appreciate that CJ calls him out on it and says like, what is this? Yes. And he's like, you know, and it is sort of what it is. And I also just want to say too, that where they land Danny and CJ at the end of the series is really, really beautiful. And
I think I think that colors a lot of my feeling on them too, because I really do like the way that they end up together.
I want to just rewind to Mandy one more time very quickly here, because there's something else that we didn't really get to, which is the frustration that she thinks Josh feels about the fact that Bartlett listens to her. And that she weaponizes that to get him to, by him, I mean Bartlett, to put negotiator into the hostage situation, which obviously, you know, goes sideways when the hostage negotiator is wounded, and it's a whole thing. And that's, and Mandy feels guilty for that. Yeah. It's also probably the last time that Bartlett listens to her, which is another sort of like, you've taken Mandy, you've put her up, and now you've torn her down. And now it's just like, they kind of just don't do anything with her moving forward.
Well,
really.
And it's a very atypical Bartlett decision. I think it's really interesting that we don't see the scene where she convinces him to listen to her, to send in, because her argument there is, we need to send in the mediator. It probably won't work, but the optics will be better if we do, if we try to exhaust an option before we go and charge in. And obviously a lot of this storyline, Ruby Ridge is a big antecedent, but like also the Waco raid and the Elian Gonzalez situation, both of those things, which made Janet Reno and the Justice Department sort of feel like villains within the Clinton administration. So like all this stuff was like a lot more recent in mind. And so I could see where like that, you know, in formulating that storyline, the media consultant would be very aware of, this is going to make us look bad the way that, you know, unspoken, the way that like, you know, it's looked bad for the Clinton administration. Yeah. But I think it's really interesting that we don't see that scene, because it doesn't seem like the thing that Bartlet would do, which is make a decision purely based on enhancing the optics of it. And
I totally agree.
And
which is why we don't see it.
Which is, I think, why we don't see it. Yes.
Yeah. I think that the closest we get is a look between Bartlet and Mandy, where there's sort of this like acknowledgement of what she's trying to do and say, and Bartlet kind of acknowledging it. It's what's interesting about it too is, and this speaks to your point, we don't really see any Bartlet-Mandy scenes because I think that Aaron Sorkin recognizes that Bartlet wouldn't have these scenes with Mandy. So this off-screen relationship that exists holds no water for us as a viewer, because we're just sort of like, wait, what's happening? I didn't see it, so how am I supposed to really believe it? It's unfortunate. The other thing that I think is interesting too about the getting rid of Mandy is that the Joey Lucas character that's brought in season two, in a lot of ways, checks a lot of the boxes that Mandy checks in terms of public opinion.
She gets brought in season one. We're probably not too far away from Joey Lucas, actually.
Oh, maybe you might.
Because she's in the California episode.
Oh, you're right. She's absolutely in the California episode. So it does feel like, weirdly, when Joey Lucas is brought in, she makes Mandy that much more superfluous to the show moving forward. Let's talk a little bit for a second here about this interpreter fiasco that plays out, which is that Donna has found we basically realize that the interpreter that Donna found doesn't speak the same language as the Indonesian official that they need. So Josh and Toby, it creates a broken telephone situation where like there's two interpreters that need to interpret each other, which is very classic Sorkian kind of playfulness of like how long this conversation would take to actually transpire. And there's a great joke of Josh being like, what do you think about dinner? Like there's something great about like Josh trying to like have just a normal conversation, and Toby's being like, no,
Toby being like, we do not have time for that.
Which is great. It's also great that it tees up a funny scene that quickly turns into Toby being kicked in the balls by this Indonesian official, which is, I think, fucking phenomenal.
You really didn't see it coming. Like, it really comes as a big surprise, because you're right. It is sort of framed as almost like the comic relief moment with like this, you know, almost like Marx Brothers-esque game of telephone. And Donna's presence in there sort of enhances that too. And I did like the one moment where, because Toby has this one really obnoxious moment where he like tries to like one up this cook for like not speaking English. And at the very least, Don is the one to just be like, well, he speaks, you know, Indonesian and Portuguese, so I wouldn't look down your nose. Like, that was at least good. But like, Toby's kind of a jackass in this episode. And I think maybe that's because this, you know, because this moment is coming where this Indonesian official, who turns out does speak English, is basically like, oh, so now you need a favor from me after you wrote this speech where your president essentially just like embarrasses my president in front of the entire world for, and like, obviously, you know, Indonesian human rights abuses are, you know, a real thing.
Egregious.
And certainly above my pay grade, but like, I watch documentaries too. So like, I at least like, you know what I mean? It's just like,
I agree. I think the reason that one of the myriad of reasons that this episode works so well is because there are wins and there are losses. And there's more losses than wins when everything is said and done. And I think that it's one of the first episodes of the show where you get the real feeling that this administration is not going to win every time. Like it can't just be a cavalcade of rah-rah Bartlet administration. and showing Toby's flaws, showing his lack of humility, his lack of ability to be able to see that he's just, you know, verbally abused this president and has the audacity to talk about human rights in comparison to the various, you know, human rights issues that might very well exist in America and say, like, do me a solid is just is a crazy thing. But I would also say too, and this is a testament to Richard Schiff's tremendous acting, as is everybody's, but his in particular, what he can do with a look, like, it's all over Toby's face of just knowing, oh my God, what have I done? My friend who's trapped in a prison, like, all this stuff is all just
you
all
can
over
see
face.
The moment where he realizes that he's overplayed his hand, and it's just like, and he really, and you're right, that, like, that look on his face, because the stakes in it are are huge for him, because he has this friend who's in a prison. Like, I can't imagine being a political prisoner in Indonesia is anything less than incredibly fraught. And he knows that by his own, it's like Sam has a couple moments like this too, when he, when his friend during the election storyline leaks the tape or whatever. And Sam realizing that he fucked this up, and it's, this one's on him. And I think Toby has this kind of moment right here. And I like that Josh is there.
Sorry,
go ahead. No,
I was just gonna say that has one of my favorite Leo lines, where he's like, I don't appreciate what Sam did, but you got to love the way that he did it. There's like an outline of Sam in a wall somewhere.
Yeah, Sam shaped hole in the wall.
Yeah.
John Spencer has a great line in this episode too. It's not even a line, but the moment where he gets the news about the hurricane changing direction, and the look on his face and the way he reacts to that is just so incredibly, like, your blood runs a little cold, and you're just like, you feel exactly the dread that he's feeling of just like, this is going to get bad. And
well, that comes to the revelation at the end of season 4, when Zoe's kidnapped, and the look on John Spencer's face as he's running to tell Bartlett. John Spencer is unbelievable on this show. You know, he was the first one cast, which I think is really interesting. I think it's one of the many reasons why this show didn't continue, but the death of John Spencer felt like a real sort of like, this show can't continue without this character.
Right.
And he was just tremendous on the show. And his relationship also with Abby, we talked about that a little bit, but the chemistry that he has with Stalker Channing.
The Fred Astaire moment where he starts to do the little dance. It's so wonderful.
It's wonderful. I also think too that just for what it's worth, there is a nice Donna moment when the Indonesian official speaks English, and she turns to Josh and said, "Let's just focus on the things that I did right." Which I think is great. I really do appreciate all of that. I think that this is. I want to talk very briefly about this Lori Sam stuff a second. We've got the storyline exists. We have them in a diner together earlier on, where she's studying, and there's a cute scene in clearly in the diner that they shoot ER in as well.
That makes perfect sense. Yes, now that you say that, I'm just like, yep. That's right.
So it's the same diner. And the two of them have a sweet banter. I don't dislike them when they're not in political situations. Like, when it can just be kind of two people, I do appreciate it, and I do like it. She shows
that scene
up.
Really made me want to have a chicken salad sandwich with a pickle.
Yes.
Too. Like, it really sold the diner of it all. Yeah.
So she shows up at the state dinner with a fundraiser named Cal Everett. It's absurd to me that she had no idea she was going to the state dinner. It's implausible to me that she didn't know that.
Yeah.
But the line that really kind of breaks me on this storyline in this episode is Sam turning to Lori and saying, "I'll give you $10,000 not to go home with that guy tonight."
Yeah.
I hate this storyline so much.
It's really bad.
I hate that that Sam thinks he can buy her away from somebody. It's all gross and awful. Anyway, please.
There's a moment in a few episodes where Toby just goes, "Oh, you don't think you're not trying to reform her, are you? Oh God, you're trying to reform her." And it's just like, and that's sort of the comedic end to it, but it really is just like, it again, it's back to Sorkin's unfortunate tendencies towards these sort of like paternalistic attitudes about this kind of thing. And like, we're not supposed to see Sam as the good guy, but we're supposed to see his impulses as righteous. And I don't see that either. Like, it's just, it's incredibly retrograde. Like, we've obviously, we've evolved a lot in the last, 20 years or so about our attitudes about things like sex and sex work and things like that, or at least maybe a lot of people have. But, like, even still, it's just, like, this assumption that, well, Sam just wants what's best for her. So our sympathies should still be with him. And if you like take even a second to come at it from Laurie's perspective, you're just like, this, like all of the discomfort is on her end. And like, what a horrible position for her to be in. And on the night where like she has this lovely experience where she meets the first lady and is clearly incredibly moved or whatever. And like, and he's there just sort of like ruining it. And you never get the sense that, like, is he in love with her? No, he's already flirting with Mallory in other episodes. It's not even like, it's like, he just seems like he's on his horse, trying to white knight this whole situation just for the value of like improving a young woman's life. And it's just like, shut up.
I couldn't agree with you more. It starts in the pilot where he accidentally finds out that he slept with a call girl. Right. And from that point on, it's guilt that he slept with a call girl mixed with I can fix her and save her. Mm-hmm. And then unfortunately, it's turned then into a plot device to sort of ramp up pictures that ultimately start to happen of like him with this, and it ultimately goes nowhere. He buys her a briefcase for graduation and it ultimately just peters off into nothingness. But it's a mess. And it's so unfortunate too, because I think that had Sam's storyline been stronger, I think that Sam's character moving forward would have had such a better base to work from. I'm not saying that the show wouldn't have ultimately became what it became, which is obviously the Bartlett show in terms of that him being the center of the show.
Right.
But this storyline really sealed Sam Seaborn's fate as not being the lead of this television show.
Yeah, I think that's right. So. And it's funny because West Wing, because it has such a strong pilot, its pilot is like incredibly well regarded and rightly so. It's an incredible pilot. There is this sense that like the show had it nailed from like the beginning. Yeah. And like you watch season one again, and there's a lot of stuff like this, and there's Mandy and it's whatever. And it's just like, they were still getting it. They were still, moving towards whatever. And I guess credit to the show for eventually dropping the things that weren't working. But while they're in it, it's really, really tough to watch. And it's especially tough to watch. Again, we talked about Lisa Edelstein being a great actress. And it's just like, I want so much more for her. I wish she could have been able to, like, if that storyline never existed, she could have showed up in season 3 or 4 as a congresswoman or something like that. And it would have been, whatever.
I totally agree. I want to just underline one more time. The scene that Martin Sheen and Stalker Channing have together is not just tremendous because they're great actors, but like, hearing that they didn't know each other, hearing that they didn't know much about their backstory, but their marriage. And when you see the two, you absolutely 1000% buy that these two have been married for a million years. Yeah. It does help that like, they also seem like perfectly matched visually too. Like they both, like they just have this perfect sort of height and everything's just kind of like this perfect little package. Mm-hmm. At the very end of the episode, Bartlett is, connected with the Hickory, which is a small maintenance ship that is amongst all of these battle carriers in the middle of a hurricane. I think ultimately it ended up being like 1,200 men or something, or 12,000 men or some crazy number of people.
In the whole group,
things. So, and we don't ever get a body count. But that being said, Bartlett is connected with this small ship and he's connected with this kid in the radio shed, basically, on this boat. I literally get goosebumps thinking about it. It makes me cry every time.
It's really good.
Tremendous scene. Yeah. It's so basically the beginning of the scene is interesting too, because the officer who connects Bartlett says, I have this guy in the radio shed. And he says,
we're trying to get the captain, but the only person we have now is this guy.
And Abby, like, must be kidding.
Abby's the one who is just like, talk to the boy.
And it's such a grounded moment where Bartlett, who starts very sort of like puff chest president, ready to talk to it, whatever. Yeah. And then by the end of it is sitting down, like almost cradling this telephone, talking to this boy. And the last line of the episode is, well, I don't know, man, it's pretty bad. I think I'd ask for my money back. I'm going to stay right here as long as the radio works.
It's almost tremendous. Like outside of the regular Bartlett cadence, which I love too, where it's like, it's not delivered like a regular Bartlett line. It almost feels like, it's like Apocalypse Now, Martin Sheen, right? It's sort of just like, he feels a lot younger. He's sort of like, he's powerless. He's absolutely powerless to help. And all he can do is just sort of like, just talk to this kid. Yeah. And I remember from watching it the first time, I remember it being like a really big, just like, oh wow, like this is really something special. And also the way that like Tommy Shalhoub, like, pushes the camera in, because it starts as this wide shot and that's on all of them, and then he just like tightens right onto Bartlett's face, and then that's the end of it. That's sort of where it like fades to black, because like, and we never find out if the negotiator lived, we don't know how that Teamster strike was settled, and we don't know what ultimately, I assume that this kid died. So the other thing, I don't know if you remember, he brings it up again in Two Cathedrals when he's yelling at God, when one of the things that he mentions is the tender ship in the bay or whatever, and when he's saying like, was Josh Lyman just a warning shot, like that kind of stuff. And I was just like, it's like it made an impact on him. Clearly this was something that stuck with him.
I could not possibly agree with you more. It's one of those things too where the economy of words is something that people don't necessarily say that about Aaron Sorkin. They think that he's a person who uses a lot of words, and he does. But there's an economy in the words that he's choosing, and telling us, you know, that the kid's bleeding, that his head is bleeding, telling us the size of the waves and the green water that's coming over, and like all of these details allow you to visualize what this boy is in the middle of, so that it's that much more harrowing. It's that much more. Obviously tragic. It's a really, really beautiful scene. And it's one of the scenes that always stuck with me about this show. Yeah. Obviously there's many of them, and I'm very excited to hear about your favorite episode, but I do think that there are these scenes, these moments that for whatever reason, whenever I rewatch them, always gets me. Donna talking to her high school teacher in the Oval Office always gets me. I might take issue with Stirred as an episode to some degree or another, specifically the hockey stuff. I don't know why Aaron Sorkin hates hockey as
it's
much.
It's such a weird scene.
but that's the episode that it's in.
Yeah.
But all that being said, it's like there's these things where you're just like, my God, he just knows how to get that blade in between your ribs and just really get to you. It's really unbelievable. And it's interesting that you talk about the fact that there are all these ellipses at the end of this episode, which becomes a hallmark of the show. You know, Sorkin's not necessarily interested in rounding off every story and making sure that everything comes with a nice bow. Right. But you know that by Bartlett basically threatening the unions and the corporations with various...
Right. The semiotics of all these things, you can sort of like, you sense. I do feel like if I were to put money on it, obviously the Teamster strike seems to be like, it's going to get settled.
Yeah.
If I were to bet, I'd say the negotiator survives, but like is probably pretty badly hurt and whatever. And like this kid that he's talking to on the radio, like all of the visual language of this says like this kid's going to die. Like this kid's not going to make it through it. Yeah. And
It's the other thing too, there's like a nice little hint of this as well. And they go farther with this more so in the John Wells years than the Sorkin years. But Leo's military background comes into play as well a little bit here too. It's a little bit of a hint of like the radio show. And the idea of like that they're trying to find the captain and giving sort of Bartlett a little bit of the lay of the land from a sort of military perspective as to this ship and all these things that are going on, which I think is really interesting. Again, something that's hit pretty hard, very hard, in fact, in these first handful of episodes is Bartlett's inexperience when it comes to the military, inexperience with the chiefs, the Joint Chiefs, all that kind of stuff. So it is interesting to see how all that's kind of pushed away for Bartlett to just connect with this young man who's in a tragic situation. Yeah. So what's your favorite episode, Joe?
All right. So I made a little bit of a list because I didn't want to like forget anything.
Yeah, I got nowhere to
be. I love Indians in the Lobby because of the Butterball Hotline scene is really, really fantastic. Like, I can't not include that. I think that's just an A-plus storyline and some of the best, just fantastic. I do love the early Ainsley episodes. I think it's surely to their credit and so sort of wonderfully, and is, you know, classic Sorkin, Gilbert and Sullivan. Stackhouse filibuster rules. Stackhouse filibuster is so fantastic and borrows that format from Sports Night where they're all writing letters, writing emails home. The Supremes, the only really great episode from season 5, with Glenn Close.
Glenn Close, yeah.
I have to throw on U.S. Poet Laureate because I love Laura Dern, but also because it's about television without pity. It's about Aaron Sorkin going on the television without pity message boards and freaking out. Like, that's the inspiration for the Josh storyline in that episode. I was not working there then. I started working there after, but I remember after I got that job and I was telling my parents about it. And I'm like, and my dad's the biggest West Wing fan out there. And so I said to my dad, I'm like, they're the ones who that episode was about. And that's how we knew that I was in a really cool job. But my favorite episode.
Yes.
Always, it's Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. It's so good. The way that episode like recalibrates that season and just like galvanizes everything and lets them fail big so that they can like regroup at the end. And that was an episode where, because that's sort of almost to the end of season one. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching that. And again, I watched this at college it's not like I had like friends who watched The West Wing with me. No, it was just me. And I remember watching that and I just said to myself, I'm just like, this is a great freaking TV show. Like, this is just a really, really fantastic TV show. And
it hones in on the Toby Bartlett relationship in an interesting way too, which as I've spoken about in previous episodes, but I'll talk about it a little bit more here too. I think is one of the best relationships on the show because it is so water and oil that the frustration that, and I alluded to this in a previous episode, there's almost a Tony Soprano Melfi kind of relationship between Bartlett and Toby, the frustration of a powerful man who knows he needs someone else's help, who has another person inside their head and hates that person knows their psyche better than they do. And it's a fascinating relationship. And the Let Bartlett Be Bartlett thing is a recurring theme when it comes to the Toby Bartlett thing, of Toby being like, just fucking be yourself. Like, stop being worried that you're not achieving something, some unrealistic goal that your father set for you or whatever it is. I think it's really fascinating stuff.
That one, I think the Let Bartlett Be Bartlett, though, that's Leo who gets that scene.
Right.
The Toby I think that one is... I think it's like Hartsfield Landing, the one where they're playing chess.
That's where they play chess. Also, there's 17 people, which is...
17 people, right, yeah. Right. The big Toby scene in Let Bartlett Be Bartlett is weirdly with Leo, where Leo's like, if you're going to jump ship, like, let me know. And then Toby's
Right.
He's just like, I'm not crazy about you questioning my loyalty in that one. Let Bartlett Be Bartlett is also sort of, that's the end of Mandy, right? That's the last big thing Mandy gets to do it's her memo that like gets found out and whatever. And then like they wrap that up and then like that's the end of Mandy. Like,
yeah, it's, I stand by the fact that it is absolutely crazy that there isn't even a line that someone says about where Mandy went. Like, it is that they are that vanished.
Well, and that her last episode, because she's in that finale, the last episode is one where there's this like giant shootout and it's like, is that why there's no more Mandy? Nobody ever says. She doesn't come back for Leo's funeral. That's one of my other like little pet things is like seeing everybody who got brought back for Leo's funeral and who, you know, and obviously who didn't. But that's a really fascinating. I wish season 7, I really like season 7. One of the bad things about it is the way it ends, the Toby Bartlett relationship. That's really, really bad. Yes. But like, it's a fascinating season. I wish the episodes as episodes were more sort of memorable in a way that like the early ones was. Like season 7 just sometimes seems like one big long episode. And that's fine.
Well, because it's so like scattered.
All the campaign stuff.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
And I agree with you about the fact that like John Spencer dying really made that the point to end the show. But I am always fascinated by the administration, what the Santos administration is. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that would be great. Because it's like, Sam is back. Amy has a job in the administration. Mm-hmm. Like, you got Garofalo on board. You got, you know.
I'd watch the shit out of that show.
I'd watch the hell out of that show. Like, like Vinick is Secretary of State. Yeah. I'm in. Like, yeah. Ed O'Neill looks like he's going to be the vice president. Awesome. Yeah. Like, cool. It's very interesting. It's an interesting.
So this leads to a question I have for you, which is, would you want to see some sort of a Aaron Sorkin Netflix-y revival thing in the vein of what they did with Gilmore Girls with West Wing? Is that something that you would want? I think the show ended satisfactorily. I'm fine with how it ended. Yeah. That being said, would you be interested in seeing Aaron Sorkin's words, Aaron Sorkin end some sort of period at the end of a sentence of his own writing?
No.
Okay.
I would watch it. I would absolutely watch it. I would be petrified as to what would become of everything. The politics of the left has changed significantly since then. Yes. And like that White House is not the White House that like is like they were the liberal darling back then, and like they wouldn't function that way now. Honestly, I know I mention Amy Gardner a lot, but like Amy's the most 2021 compatible character on that show just from her politics. Like Toby's really like right-wing reactionary on a lot of foreign policy stuff. Leo also is too. Like post 9/11, Leo and Toby both become like these like massive hawks in a way that like is really interesting. And I also feel like what is Jed Bartlett and his MS looking like 20 years on? Do you know what I mean? Like, do we have to confront the realities of that? And I just, there was that little, small little tempest in a teapot around the election where Aaron Sorkin talked about how he would write the end of the Trump administration and, you know, that he would basically have like the Republicans in Congress like tell him it's time to stop and whatever. And it's like, part of me was just like, Sorkin was a little more prescient than you knew, and that he knew that that would be the only thing that could stop him. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. But it also sort of exposes the sort of the fairy tale of what Sorkin feels like politics should be and a way that politics very much isn't. And I think the differences in that would make any kind of modern day West Wing feel pretty excruciating. I just wouldn't want to see it end that way.
I mean, listen.
People would hate it too. Like, Phil, people would absolutely tear it to shreds.
I'm not saying that I really want it necessarily. Yeah. Is there a part of me that would love to see the gang get back together to help Charlie run for Senate or something like that?
Sure.
Kinda. There's a little bit of me that kinda,
I get it.
That would be nice to see.
I get it.
But I agree with you 100% that I... that Aaron, and it's so interesting too, because it does feel like every election cycle that happens, somebody says, well, we got to get Aaron Sorkin's take on this election, right?
I mean, like, why do we? Why really?
Why? He's not even a particularly politically minded individual, really. He's not even really plugged into politics. Yes, he wrote a show about politics, but like, you don't really want his opinion because his opinion, quite frankly, is he's middle of the road. Like, he's not particularly far right, far left. He's vanilla.
Right. I'm always just like, why are we, what did we expect? What did we expect Aaron Sorkin's take on cancel culture to be? Like, for God's sake, like, just stop this.
The funny part of all of this, if you ask me, and I think that as a fellow Aaron Sorkin fan, you'll hopefully agree with me, is that ultimately, I don't really think that Aaron Sorkin cares what the words are. He just wants them to sound a certain way in his ears.
Yeah.
Like, it's just music to him. So like, he's not even all that invested in what these characters are really saying. He just likes the idea of debate, banter, and how that sounds in his head. And he needs people to give him enough research so that the people sound smart. That's really
He's got these sort of bugaboos, and some of them I'll agree with and some of them I won't. He's always has a thing for education is demonized in this country. And it's one of those things where it's just like, I kind of agree with that. Yes. But you'll see it, that'll pop up in a lot of things he does. And sometimes it's things like, protesters are usually in it for the glory of it all. And I'm just like, I don't know know about that, Aaron. And you sort of like, you can see in Chicago 7, he's finally sort of starting to come around on that, at least wrestle with that a little bit. Yes. But like, there's stuff in the West Wing where like, see, Toby's going out. It's just like, I'm going to teach these kids how to protest like old school. And I'm just like, whatever, Toby. So he definitely has like, there are things he believes about politics and the way the world works and that kind of a thing. And those show up time and time again. But he doesn't have like a coherent political thesis.
Ideologically, he's just not particularly deep is ultimately kind of what I'm getting at. Like, I think it's pretty surface for him. I mean, he's a boomer, man. Like, he's the boomer of boomers. Like, it's crazy. Even like just his needle drops are so dad rock. Like, he's just a boomer. That's what it is.
As the child of two incredibly, you know, well-meaning boomers, like I get it, and I'm sympathetic to it. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm very fine with letting Aaron Sorkin let Sorkin be Sorkin. You know what I mean? That's sort of where I come across in that. Just like he occupies a very specific space, and I think as long as we don't, you know, afford him any more gravity than he deserves.
Yes.
I am very fine with letting him do the things that he does.
You know, I think that applies to a lot of different writers too. Like, I think that part of the problem ultimately is that, and I think it's what happened with the newsroom specifically. Mm-hmm. He got too inside his head. He got too inside of what he thinks people want from him. You can see it with lots of filmmakers too. You can see it with Cameron Crowe as well, like making films that he thinks people want from him. And rather than like, just do you, man, like do a thing that you care about and maybe someone else will care about it and it will connect with people. But this idea of trying to check boxes and stuff, it's dangerous.
Well, the newsroom always makes me think of when people sort of talked about how much they hated Studio 60, because it was about a late night show, but it wasn't funny, and it didn't, and everything that we saw of the late night show was like excruciatingly unfunny. And a lot of the criticism of it was, why, if you're going to make a show about a TV show, just make it about a news show. That's what you do well. And a lot of the newsroom feels like Sorkin being like, all right, I'll do that. Like, now I'm doing that. Yeah. Like, recognize me. And the best things about the newsroom weren't about the news. They were like, they were the storyline in the second season about, like, I guess like getting the Genoa story wrong. Like, that was like about reporting and whatever. And I think that was very compelling, but it's like Marsha Gay Harden and Jane Fonda, like, you know, getting high at a party or whatever. I'm like, that's what I want. Like, that's fun for me.
It is really interesting. Like, the newsroom is an example of him getting over his skis a little bit. It's him also getting really burned by writing a show in a vacuum and not knowing public reaction to it until it was already done, which was something that he wasn't accustomed to. At least with Studio 60, for what it's worth, he sort of tried to course correct. But like, I think with Newsroom, the course correction was the second season, which is arguably the best season of the three. Absolutely. In terms of the fractured narrative, and that really helped him. I think he understood that there were no stakes if everyone knows how these various news stories play out.
Right. Like, the best storyline was the one that got invented whole cloth, because you're a writer of fiction, just write fiction. Yeah.
Which is so funny to me too, that he thought, I mean, the thing about the West Wing is it's all fake politics, right? It's all fake countries. It's all fake whatever. Yeah. And we can plug and play whatever we want in terms of what really happened, and we can do that. But the idea that he committed himself to real stories was so bad an idea. Like, I don't know why he thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
It, not only because it just felt like, you know, when you had arguably a scene that still weirdly makes me cry, even though it makes my brain melt at the same time, is the shooting episode in the first season where Fix You's playing and I'm like, this shouldn't work. Why am I crying? Stop. Like, this is terrible. But like, it's somehow working. It's that type of stuff that is antithetical to his writing. It's very strange.
Jeff Daniels yelling, "You're a fucking newsman, Don," to Tom Sadowski's character in that show. I have an old coworker who, like, the two of us would just like randomly just like say that to each other. It was very
fun. Great. There's good stuff there. It's just it's
bombastic and it's, you know, completely over the top. And yet, like, again, there's just the way in which those characters speak to each other, irrespective of what they are actually saying. Like, poor Emily Mortimer's character is like such a disaster, but like, she's got some great, like, lines of dialogue in there because she's you know, can really sell it. Olivia Munn manages to like carve out the most ridiculous character into somebody who I think is like really, really entertaining on that show. And
her and what's his face? Amanda Seyfried's husband are the best couple in that show. Tom Sedoski is
her husband. Holy shit. I didn't even realize that.
Their relationship weirdly turns into the one you're rooting for the 100%,
most. 100%. It comes from, oh, these two characters have really good chemistry together. Let's write towards that rather than like the other relationships, which a lot of the time feel very top down and very much just like, you know, Will and Mackenzie are meant for each other.
I'm going to go fucking watch the newsroom now. You've made me now. I really want to go watch the newsroom.
Now I've done it. Yeah, you're going to go and watch the newsroom.
Like, God damn it. A very strange show. But this will be the last question and I'll let you go. Do you want to see Aaron Sorkin work in television again?
Yes.
Do you think? I guess the grander question is: do you think he's a better TV writer or feature writer? I guess is the more specific question.
I don't know if I necessarily have an opinion on that. I feel like I think he's written movies that I've liked and movies that I haven't liked, and I think he's made TV shows that I've liked and TV shows that I haven't liked as much. And I think the idea of him sort of TV tends to sometimes be the place where he comes to air out his grudges. That was the other thing about Studio 60, is everybody on that show had a real life antecedent. And everybody on that show felt like he was, you know, he was settling scores with Kristen Chenoweth and he was settling scores with, what's her name, Maureen Dowd. And it was all this sort of stuff. Right, exactly. Every freaking show he has to have a Maureen Dowd version on it. It's just like, we get it. Part of that's really interesting. Part of that's kind of fascinating. And like, I think with the TV shows, perversely enough, when they're bad, they're at least really fascinatingly bad. And I think sometimes his movies, like Charlie Wilson's War, where it's just like, I don't think about Charlie Wilson's War very much because it's
I think of one scene, the Philip Seymour Hoffman yelling at John Slattery. Yeah.
which is a scene that he borrows. Wait, what? Who else does the I'm Never Ever Sick at Sea? Oh, Malice. That scene is borrowed from Malice. And also just like every other scene where like a Sorkin character like runs down their resume for somebody.
It's great. I will say this. I think that first of all, on the Studio 60 front, there is something utterly fast. I've rewatched Studio 60 far too many times than I'm willing to admit. And I
admire your fortitude, Phil. I really do.
There is something fascinating about Matt and Danny being his ego and his id. Like that he is literally a split of Aaron Sorkin in two characters, I think is hilarious and insane. But I also just think that it's possible that Aaron Sorkin works better in an episodic nature than he does in a feature. I love Moneyball and I love Social Network. I think they're both great movies. I'm not suggesting he doesn't know how to write features. He obviously does.
Right.
But there's something compact and formulaic that I think actually works for him. When he's working within a formula, I do think that it gives him a little bit of a freedom to speak in a way that he doesn't in features that I think is interesting.
Yeah.
For good and bad. I mean, as we've said, some of his shows are fantastic. Some of his shows aren't, but you know,
right.
More than anything, Joe, I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. I love the opportunity to just like gab on about The West Wing. I could truly do it for days on end. Like,
I believe me when I tell you that, I'm going to do Sports Night as well. So okay. I'd love to have you on, talk about maybe Sports Night if that's something you'd be interested in as well.
Totally.
And obviously in the future, we can't wait to have you back to talk about a movie or talk about something else in that.
Can't wait to come back. I love this. I really appreciate this format you guys have here. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.